Hello and welcome to Calm Versations with the Voice of Reason. I am your host, Benjamin Boyce, and today's guest is Nancy Rommelman, who is a New York-based ex-Portland, Oregon resident, journalist, and author. And she's been doing a lot of reporting on the state of Portland since the 2020 fiascos involving Portland going off the rocker. She has written a number of short stories and nonfiction novels, one of which is To the Bridge, A True Story of Motherhood and Murder. And in this conversation, we speak about journalism and storytelling and the relationship between truth and the ways that truth is conveyed through media. Wonderful guest. She is launching Paloma Media imminently, and I will link that down in the description. It kind of sounds like a Hogwarts for Gen X thinkers and intellectuals and artists, and it should be a very good time. So definitely check that out and follow the links buried in the description of this episode. Without further ado, here is Nancy Rommelman.
Benjamin Boyce.
I was looking on your Wikipedia page and...
Oh. Who knows where that came from? I'm like, no. What?
Well, it's very straightforward, but it implies that you've been involved in journalistic activity since 1994.
That is correct. I decided one day to be a journalist, and that's what happened. So I don't know. Yes, I have. I wrote my first feature article, which was driving across the country to interview the serial killer John Wayne Gacy in 1994. Just jump into the deep end of the pool, and I never wanted to do anything else, and I haven't done anything else except journalism since then. So
before then, you're probably into writing at least.
You know, it's funny because my friends growing up and in high school, and my mom says, "Don't you remember you were always writing? You were always writing." And I'm like, "Was I? I don't really recall that. And if I were, it was not with deliberation or not." I kind of thought I was going to be a movie star when I was a kid. Okay. So like I didn't need to do anything else except just exist and then kind of just sort of float into my future. So I may have always, and I have to say I'm extremely glad I did not become a movie star. I don't really recall that. But I guess I was a good writer. I knew that. Like I knew how to write. People would respond to it. But then when I realized I could do it, now if we want to really think about it, I remember in college, a boyfriend saying to me, "You really should be a writer." And I said, "Oh, I can't do that," because it was such an amazing thing to be. I didn't think I would be allowed to be that.
Oh, really? But a movie star was just something that would automatically.
A movie star was a cakewalk. So, then when I finally started, I was like, oh man, that's it. I am never doing anything else. That's all I want to do.
Well, what was it about journalism as opposed to, fiction or other forms of writing?
Well, I have done some fiction. You know, when I started to write, I was doing both. I was writing fiction and I was writing nonfiction. And I remember in about 1995, kind of having to decide what I wanted to do because I was actually getting some success as a journalist. I was very fortunate. I was kind of hit the ground running and I was making a living. I was like supporting a little kid and kind of just like making it work. And I was like, what am I going to do? And fiction world is, I was much more attracted to journalism. I found it a lot sexier, a lot more fun, a lot of more current. And I just made the decision to do that. Now, every once in a while, a little bit of fiction will pop out. And that's fine. But I don't consider myself a fiction writer.
So you didn't invent a John Wayne Gacy whole cloth from your imagination then? You found him in the real world?
I didn't. And you know, unfortunately, a lot of people know that. You know what I heard? But I was so crazy busy the other day. My mom actually told me, she said they found another one of his victims recently.
I saw that.
And I'm so bad. I have not even looked that up. I've just been running from pillar to post, but I do want to. And I will say, I mean, as horrible as it is, at least for the family to finally know what happened to, I'm sure it was a young man. He only, as far as I know, killed young men. So that's, you know, I don't believe in closure really, but I think you would want to know, if someone's been missing for 30 years, at least, you know, I mean, as bad as the fate is that it, that that's what happened.
What was your frame of mind to put you on that story?
Well, it was not my idea. I was living in Hollywood. There was a dude. He was like kind of an artist, party guy on the scene, impresario, musician. He was a pen pal of John Wayne Gacy's. And Gacy was up for execution. This guy and I had a mutual friend who said the guy had gotten himself on Gacy's visiting list to go see him before he was executed. And he thought it would make a good story. And I was like, that does sound kind of like a story. So you know, the way journalism works is you sell the idea, you pitch it, and I pitched it and it sold. And so we got in a car, we drove cross country, and I had not written features before, but I kind of understood in my skin how to write this story, which was to sort of take the emotional temperature of people as you cross the country. Like Gacy was huge. You know, he was almost a household name, and people had
bigger than OJ maybe.
Well, different, okay. Maybe no. Not bigger than OJ, okay. But certainly, you know, one of these notorious people that, you know, what made him notorious? Of course, his crimes made him notorious, but we made him notorious. We create these, you know, these anti-icons or whatever you want to call them. And I just kind of, again, I just stopped and I talked to like some college students, like a boyfriend of mine in New Mexico and his crew. And then I stopped at a bar in Texas, and then some Native American relatives. My daughter is half Native American in Oklahoma. I went to church with them, and just kind of like everybody knew where I was going, and everybody had something to say interesting about it, and very, very, very varied. And I thought, wow, this is such Americana, you know? And then getting into see Gacy and seeing who he was up close, which is a very, as I don't know if I've put it in the piece, but I've said it before. He was about as like intimidating as your dry cleaner. He was very chatty, very, hey, kids, how you doing? Let me get you, you know, hey, get these kids some chicken McNuggets, and like talky and talky. But also, because I've written about people like this since, one of these sort of charming is a bad word to apply to Gacy, but one of these kind of charming sociopaths that's just very, very, he's hungry to connect with you and to make you think that you're important. But it's an episode of The Gacy Show. It was, it's an interesting piece. It was written before the internet existed as we know it. And so it was republished by a little outfit a couple of years ago. It's on Amazon. It's called, it used to be called Going to Gacy, which is a better name, but they renamed it Destination Gacy. You can go, I think it's like $1.99. You can you can go buy it and read it. And I think it's a pretty good piece for a young woman's first piece of journalism.
Well, not that you believe in closure, but there's a symmetry, somewhat of a symmetry between that, your first piece, and then this most recent book of yours.
Well, you know what? It's interesting. People want to, and this is normal. People like to understand like who you are as a writer. And like for a long time, I used to do a lot of food writing for Bon Appetit for 10 years, not on staff, but, you know, like I contributed. And so people would call me like a food writer. Meanwhile, I'm like, well, I did write about this murdered kid last month, but they need to put you in a little in a category. That's fine. People need shorthand. But I have been said, oh, you write about very dark topics. I don't actually like dark. I don't like that designation. I will say that every, I don't know, 5 or 10 years, a murder rolls across my brain pan, and I need to understand more about it. And the work you're referring to is To the Bridge, A True Story of Motherhood and Murder. Amanda Stott Smith dropped her two young children from a bridge in Portland, Oregon, May 23rd, 2009. I found out about it later that day because she'd been caught. Well, actually, no. Nothing was known except that her two children had been found in the river in Portland, in the Willamette River. One had died and one had survived. I needed to know instantly. Instantly. My poor husband, he always knows when I'm bitten by a story. He's like, oh, there she goes. And I was finding it out. And I had to understand more about how something like this happens, because the way the treatment of these kinds of stories usually go And I can't fault it. It's a news cycle. You know, other stories bump it off. But it's like, she's crazy. She's evil. Fuck her. She's in jail. Can I curse? Are we cursing? We're not cursing.
Yeah, it's too late now. We're here.
Okay,
we are.
Sorry. I apologize.
No, you're New York. I'm north of Portland. You know.
Where are you?
I'm in Olympia.
Okay. I like Olympia. Olympia's cool. This cool
city.
Not too bad. I like it. Anyway, I had to follow the story. It turned out to be, you know, all stories are complicated if you want to look deep enough, kind of. So I did. I spent like 6 or 7 years working on it. Came out in 2018. And is that story about a murder? Sure. But it's a very, very, very different story than Gacy. Yeah.
The plot of it, I've just looked at things about it.
I didn't
get a chance to read it, but it seems the organization seems like more of a network, or because it's about the family and the circumstances, and it's localized as opposed to the Gacy one, like kind of like a pearl or a necklace of some sort.
Yeah. The Gacy one was, you know, basically a journey to Gacy, the reasons why Rick, the guy I went with, had done it, meeting Gacy himself and sort of why, you know, someone like a Gacy is a cultural phenomena and how we create that phenomena and then we destroy it, right? Hmm. Amanda's story to the bridge was very much, and it's, I'm sorry for the metaphor, but like you drop a pebble in a pond and it makes the ripples. And so at the very center, you have Amanda and the children. And then there's the family is the next circle. And then there's the, you know, the friends or coworkers or citizenry or the city or the legal institutions or the people that were duped. And it's all kind of interlocks and kind of why we make the decisions we do. The book starts with the crime. You're right there. You're on the bridge. And it also ends pretty much with the crime. And I think I've said this before. Some people have said to me, I'm never, ever, ever, ever going to understand how something like this happens. And I don't care, you know, that you're going to spend your time and waste my time writing about it. And then they read the book and they go, oh, actually, I do understand something now, because the crime looks very different at the end. Once you've taken this journey with me. Anyway, I, what can I say? I had to write that book. I had no choice. I had like no agent at the time. I had no publisher at the time. I just had to, I had to figure out the story.
That's 7 years too, you said.
Well, you know, I was doing other things at the same time too.
Well, yeah,
you know,
but still, yeah.
Stuff. But yeah, it was a, well, one reason is, well, let's see, it happened in 2009. I sold the book in 2016 and I definitely took, there were a couple of times I gave up on it. I just said, I can't do this. It's too, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to tell this story, especially when people won't speak with you. But if you, I couldn't not write it. Like, I had all this information and I just, when I went back to it and started working, that's when the things started, people started opening up. You're asking them to talk about the very hardest thing that has happened in their lives. We're talking about the murder of a child, and we're talking about the fact that some of them had been duped for a long time. And you're talking about pain that is everlasting. It's hard to talk about. And, but some people needed to talk about it. And so I was able to do the book. And what's really, I think, really interesting, and I actually tweeted about this yesterday, Amanda has 3 surviving children, 1 older son who did not go with her to the bridge that night. He's in my book. I interviewed him many times. She had a daughter that she adopted out when the baby was an infant, a newborn, and she'd never met that daughter, and the daughter had never met her. That girl is now 21, and she has the surviving daughter who's 18, who was 7 when she went off the bridge. Both of those girls have reached out to me, have said, can you tell me about my mother? Can you tell me why this happened? And in the case of the daughter that was adopted out, can you put me in touch with my mother? And I was like, I don't know how many people in the world have been contacted by a mother they didn't know who murdered their siblings saying, can you put me in touch? It's kind of been, and this sort of keeps on going. I keep getting people wanting to talk to me about different parts of this story. I got a call last week from someone, it's something that I will continue, if even not to write about, but maybe it's going to sound a little weird, but maybe to be useful to people, because the story was one in which people were duped for a very, very, very long time. And some of this duping.
They were outside, from the inside, from the people around the story.
People within the story, people who are chronic liars, who kind of con artists in a sense, but not like the guy that's just going to like take your $5, but that it's going to take your trust and your faith. And when that happens, they have a way of really spectacularly ruining people's lives. And this is still ongoing.
Yeah.
So I got a call from someone last week asking me if I could like offer some elucidation. And as a journalist, you need to be really, really, really super careful about that. Like, I can't give people advice. I can only talk to them. Or, you know, if someone is like, oh, my God, where did you find those records, those things that you talked about, like those crimes that so-and-so says didn't happen, but you wrote about them in your book. I'm like, I went to the courthouse. Just you can, too, if you want to. Anyway, yeah.
Well, why did you say that a journalist can't elucidate?
Well, you can elucidate. You can talk to people, but you really can't give people advice. That's not okay. You can't steer the river, so to speak. You can get in the river. You can watch the river. You can you can be useful, but you know, you just got to be careful. I mean, Okay, I'll give you an example. So if I'm writing a story and I'm watching a parade, let's say, and a little girl dashes into the street. She's about to be run over by a car. I am definitely going to run into the street and pull her out. I'm going to save her. But you have to be careful not to sway events that you're writing about. It's a hard thing to understand. I'll give you an example that kind of shocks me and shocks other journalists. One of my favorite nonfiction writers, I think for a lot of people, is Joan Didion, right? And she wrote Slouching Toward Bethlehem, and she was in San Francisco. I think it was 1967, maybe 69, but I think 67. And she was watching, you know, she was in this house where a lot of young people were on acid, and there was like a child chewing on an electrical cord, and she's recording all this. And there was a little girl, I don't know how young, but pretty young, who had been given acid, okay, which is, I mean, this is, I actually wrote a story. I wrote an expose when I was in Portland about a church in scare quotes, that was giving kids ayahuasca, which I personally think is not a good idea. And I wrote an expose of it. Anyway, Didion was interviewed in a documentary that her nephew, Griffin Dunn, the actor and filmmaker, made. And he said to her, I think it was there that this happened, what did you think when you were in that, you know, loft and that child was tripping, you know, on acid? And she said, she looked at the camera, she's like, well, it's just gold. It's journalistic gold. Now, I understand what she's saying. I understand we've all walked into situations, someone gives you a quote when you're like, man, I couldn't make this up if I wanted to, or you just see something that just is so, puts the story so in relief. At the same time, that's scary. It's scary to realize that these things are happening and you're observing, and it's crushing to me that this would be happening to a child. You know, what would you want to do? Do you want to, you know, call social services? Maybe, you know, that's a call that you'd have to make. And you know, her thing was that it was gold. Okay. Yeah.
There's I believe either your most recent or one of your most recent Substack articles is you shaking your fist at the media in a certain way.
What? Not all the media.
Oh, no. Hashtag not all media, for sure. Present journos excluded. But what you're talking about, and that's kind of what I was thinking about talking to you about, because you have been doing this since 1994, and a lot of changes have happened.
Yeah.
And we're almost, it could be said, one of my friends, James Lindsay, was making a parallel between the way that capital has developed over time, or power or money or wealth has developed over time. There was a feudal period, and then it kind of switched into a capitalist period. And the feudal period was power was gatekept by the aristocracy or the feudal lords. And in a certain respect, that's the same thing with journalism and with knowledge. It was kept in the academy. It was kept in the media. And now we're going through this major shift with the internet and with it's more of a capitalistic economy where we're just kind of handing information from one hand to the other. And in that flurry for stabilization of, you know, journalists' livelihoods and for information itself, what we see is people trying to play the attention economy in different ways and, you know, running after the shock, running after, you know, manipulating the story or leaning
into it.
Yeah, juking it. And it's just interesting hearing you talk about these different characters that you've written about, John Wayne Gacy, and then these chronic liars that prey upon trust and faith. And this is John Wayne Gacy's show, and he makes you feel like you're the center of attention. That just, it maps onto the media marketplace, which all goes to say, I kind of want to get towards how to be a journalist or what anchors you in journalism, what anchors you in the information. It sounds like there's something that's anchoring you to this story. And then there's a bunch of probably ethical...
Anchoring me to the story or to the profession?
Okay, here, Dan Rather, he is a rather well-known media guy. He has a Twitter, and his bio is journalist and storyteller, and there's a comma between journalist and storyteller. And some of his tweets are stories, and some of his tweets are journalism. So journalism is a storytelling profession.
Sure.
But there has to be some sort of ethic involved in what you do with the story. How do you present the story and why you're even doing it?
So it's interesting. So story, you know, we think of a story, we think of a children's story, we think of fiction. But, you know, basically I think it is the journalist's job. I mean, depending on what you do, but even if you're reporting the weather, like you do want to take people on a little journey. But when I say that, I don't mean like, and you should have a little fictional flourish in there to make it a little more exciting. Because let me tell you, you will never, ever get something as exciting as telling the truth about a story. Ever. Any nonfiction writer, and I've had this happen to myself, I've had people ask me about it. If you are stymied on a story, like you're like, oh man, I'm trying to write this story, I can't get what I want, I don't know what to do, keep looking. Just keep looking. I promise you, you will find more interesting nuggets and facets and people and quotes and something
gold.
The street or even gold. Or even, look, there's not one way to do it. You can be in the middle of a story and you go in the kitchen to make yourself a fried egg and you realize that somehow when you're watching the fried egg, you can even use this image to sort of connect where you want to go to the next thing. There are no limits. And that is, I mean, for me, God, I could almost get overcome talking about this. For me, the very, very best thing about bringing a story is to construct the narrative. How are you going to tell the story? Are you going to tell the story super quiet like this? Or are you going to like barge in with a drum? Or are you going to, you know, make it sort of like you're going to look at it out of the side of your eye? There's so many ways to do it. And what you need to do is to find from your perspective, what is going to be the most compelling way to keep the reader with you? Because you really are taking the reader by the hand and leading them through this story. And if they leave, if they stop reading, that's your fault. Mm-hmm. That's not the story's fault. That's not their fault. I mean, we all have terrible attention spans. Yes. Like, please destroy Twitter for me, please. And I'll read 400 more books.
Yeah. This is why I podcast, so I can get away from that application.
That's right. It's like it is your job as the writer. That's it. And especially on a story like To the Bridge, my sister-in-law, who's also a writer, she said to me in an email, she said, we're in Krakauer territory here now, meaning John Krakauer, the writer. We need you as our guide. Like, there are some stories you don't need a guide as much, but if you're telling a difficult story, you need a guide. And in order to be the guide, you've got to create your path for the reader.
I'm sorry, could you expand on that reference to a Krakauer?
Krakauer, John Krakauer, the writer, John Krakauer, who wrote Into the Wild, and he wrote that book about the Mormon Church. That's the name is escaping me at the moment, which was great. He wrote Up in the Air, the book about Everest, where like all those people climbed Everest, and you know, a lot of them, they were like the tourist Everest climbers, and there were all these deaths. He hasn't been as prolific lately, and there's been some controversy about his last few books, but he's a great nonfiction writer. I really like his books a lot. You started asking about what tethers me to telling the stories.
Well, and journalism, and I guess it's just the background of journalism being at probably the nadir so far of public trust. Maybe in my lifetime it is. So something's going on.
People have earned and continue to earn that distrust. And, you know, it's funny. We had a conversation a couple of days ago. Someone else who considered themselves growing up pretty liberal, as I do. And you would hear the right say, oh, you know, you can't trust the media. You can't trust the liberal media. I'm like, oh, get out of here. And then, like, you see the way certain stories are being reported. Now you're like, gee, you kind of can't. And I think the best example of that recently, Jesse Singel, you know who Jesse Singel is, right, from Blocks and Reported. Yeah. He did a really great writing on this recently about the Dave Chappelle and then the Netflix people that walked out and then that comedian who showed up and he was like, I like jokes. And meanwhile, they're like shaking things in his face. And
repent, motherfucker. Just, repent, you know, motherfucker.
Repent, motherfucker. And he's standing there going, I like jokes. Can't we like jokes? Well, the AP posts a photo of him through the tambourine where it's being shaken. And it basically says, comedian Vito, I can't remember, I was going to say Girolaitis, but he's an old tennis player from like the 70s. Vito, I don't remember his last name, with a G. He says he's screaming obscenities at peaceful protesters. And it's like, well, gee, that's kind of like, and you know, a lot of people went after the AP for that. And I think Katie and Jesse on Blocked and Reported were like, okay, excuse me, how'd that happen? How did that happen? So let's talk about that. How does something like that happen? Okay, let's say I'm a freelance photographer. I go out and maybe I don't hear what happened. Maybe it's an honest mistake. I don't really hear what happened. It's crazy. I send this into I'm like, I think he's screaming. Doesn't it look like he's screaming at them? And I don't know. It was so loud. I don't know. But here's a great photo. And then maybe the editor goes, you know, the screaming at peaceful protesters matches the kind of idea of what I had. Now, I'm being very generous here, I think. I don't think that's what happened at all. I think that whoever was doing this at AP decided that they are in the protesters' camp. And so they needed an enemy, right? So he's going to be the enemy. Well, unfortunately, none of that is what happened. And so that is a very pretty bald example of, you know, the AP goes out internationally, right, of trying to juke a story in the direction you want it to go in. That is unethical journalism. It's also lying, okay? So is it hard to practice good journalism? No. It's super, super easy, okay? Don't lie. Don't lie. Don't have an agenda. Don't be like the people in Portland last summer when I was reporting that said to me, you know, if you're not, you're part of the problem because you are not, what did they want me to do? They wanted me to only report the sort of, I can't believe I'm getting so ineloquent here over this. They wanted me to
report. You have some PTSD from 2020 Portland, maybe.
That tear gas. they felt that the people that were the let's just boil it down for a second. So obviously, I think it is obvious that most protesters in this country after George Floyd was killed were peaceful protesters. This is absolutely obvious. You have millions of people marching. Most of them were completely peaceful. However, in many cities, including Portland, I think foremost, or at least for the longest amount of time, you had people that were not. And they were maybe between, depending on the night, 60 and 600 of them. Okay, you're standing there. You are watching them burn buildings, throw buckets of feces, you know, shine lasers in cops' eyes. I mean, you are there watching this, and so you report it. Well, then people come back at you and say, no, these are peaceful protesters. And I'm like, actually, they are not. I think the sense was, if you called anybody not peaceful, you were against the whole movement, which is just, it's just ridiculous. It's like, no, we're grown-ups and we can differentiate between peaceful and not peaceful. Mm-hmm. But that was seen to be anti, whatever, pro-fascist, pro-right-wing. And it's just nonsensical. And it's also so incurious. It's incurious about what's really going on. And that really bums me out.
It's salient, though.
What do you mean? It's what? What's salient?
The narrative takes precedent over other things, because the narrative, I just read that one of your pieces on Portland, you did at least two pretty extensive ones.
I did 24 pieces.
You did 24. Oh, just like me with my little state college 15
like
miles
that.
Away.
I mean, most for, I think 20 or 16 or something for Reason, and then the Dispatch and okay. Couple,
I believe I read the Dispatch
Parts
one.
Place. Yeah.
There, when you have a value such as justice that takes precedent over everything else, then the truth needs to serve justice, or even lies need to serve justice, right?
But like, who decides what justice is, right? I agree that that happens. Absolutely. And it's like, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. So I was seen, I guess, as part of the problem because I wasn't pulling in the exact same direction of the people that felt that they were right. I'm sorry. I can't agree with continually burning down or trying to burn down the police station or setting a fire in the police at Justice Center, which is like the police building, when there are employees and prisoners in the basement. You know, there's a fire, and you're doing that because you actually, in my opinion, don't have yet real ideas to implement. I understand that people are young. I understand people are angry. I completely understand that we were in the middle of COVID. They had been locked in their houses. Their jobs were gone. Schools were closed. They were not allowed to do anything. All of a sudden, they were out in the streets with their friends, fighting for justice, having the sort of physical equivalent of being in a mosh pit. Mm-hmm. I get it. I like being in a mosh pit. Well, I don't do it so much anymore. But you are getting that nightly spurt of relief, right? And you're working toward what you believe is a better world. I get all of that, and I understand the good feeling of that. However, it is the same. It's repetitive every night. And nothing gets done. They have not achieved anything, I don't think.
Well, they've increased the murder rate in Portland, I guess.
Well, the murder rate is up, I mean, in most major cities across the country. And I think that's a complicated issue. It's not good. They've been, you know, even before George Floyd was killed, you had a very, very progressive city council. You had the mayor and the police have been kind of at each other's throats for, oh God, 8 years. And there has been defunding. You know, sometimes the defunding is a little bit exaggerated, though. It's like certain programs were gotten rid of that, you know, if you want to look at it simplistically, like, well, look, they got rid of that and look what happened. It's definitely more complicated than that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think that I would hope that Portland can see that it's not really on the right path toward making it better for the average citizen. Having said that, I would like to say something that I've written about what's gone on in Portland, and then people are like, yeah, you tell him, Rommelman, it's a big shithole. The place is all big shithole. And I'm like, actually, it's really not. Okay. I was there recently. Most of Portland is beautiful. It's like people are trying to get about their lives. Now, but at the same time, it's also not, I get people saying, oh, come on, it's just relegated to two blocks. That's also not true, okay? It pops up at different parts of the city. Does the city function for the most part? Yes, it does. Is there a more and more of a increased homeless population? yes, it's an issue that the citizens are going to have to decide for themselves. They voted that they were cool with people mm-hmm. camping outdoors. They're going to have to decide whether they're still cool with it. That's not really my, if that's what they want, that they're allowed to vote that in, right? Yeah. However, I do think that the small number of sort of actively aggressive and violent actors in the city of Portland have been allowed to have a lot of oxygen. And, you know, we're in a very divided country, so that people keep looking at it. And I can't say they probably, I think there's probably people that like the spotlight, you know, of being in Portland. They're going to be the ones that keep fighting. But it is a small, it's a small contingent. However, the city council has to get it together. They just do. They do.
The what happened in Portland mirrors very closely what happened at the Evergreen State College in 2017. I was on campus for that whole thing. And
why were you there? I know Brett and Heather really well.
Oh, you do?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I've been on Dark Horse, but more than that, Heather is a dear friend. I adore her. I love her. Great. She's
yeah.
great.
Yeah,
anyway,
we're pals too. I was going to school there later on in life, and then I was just wanting to be a writer, and then all that stuff happened, and I saw the story being made out of it, and where
Michael
it wasn't
Moynihan.
Being told. Pardon me?
Michael Moynihan for Vice. Michael Moynihan did an episode for Vice. Yeah. He's in the fifth column, and they record exactly where I'm sitting. The fifth column.
Oh.
This is
okay.
our studio.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Oh, right on. He did really well with that 10-12 minute.
Great
documentary.
Yeah. Everybody should go watch that. I constantly give it to people as an example of telling the story really super well.
Yeah.
Anyway, continue.
So he did that, and then other places picked it up, and then YouTube picked it up, and it was phenomenal for a variety of cringe compilation channels because it was just so cringe, the actual footage.
Oh, yeah.
But what wasn't being shown was all these workshops, lectures, seminars that were done by the administration, by the staff and, well, the faculty. And I'd been there the whole time filming it because I worked in the media department. So okay. what I ended up doing was unearthing all the letters and all of the documents and then putting them together into, you know, a 24 episode thing where you see, yeah, I'll send you the link.
It's,
if you haven't had enough Evergreen, I'll give you all you could possibly.
Evergreen.
Possibly.
Well, maybe I have. No.
But
yes,
what happened in 2020, so I spent 4 years, well, 3 years at that point, pouring over these documents and putting this whole thing together. And then 2020 happens, and it's this the same exact thing that happened at Evergreen. You have these kids that are bottled up. They're sucking this concoction of critical theory or pressure oppressed, and they're being taught about all these ways that they're going to solve history or solve the problems of history. And then spring comes, papers are starting to be due, so they have a lot of anxiety on that. They have a lot of energy. Something happened that turned out not to really happen, or there was a scuffle on Facebook, spilled over, and the student body just said, okay, we finally have proof that Evergreen is as racist as they said that it was, because this most progressive college in the history of colleges was, you know, saying that they are just as complicit in white supremacy, blah, 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 from the top down. It's coming from the top down. And then the students rise up to confirm that. You have the whole thing. You have the whole thing that where the story is, where the attention lands, was Brett and those students, and then the students going on. But what's happening behind the scenes is that the adults in the room are
not a thing.
They're suckered. I mean, the one thing, and so when I went through, just like with your pieces on Portland, I say the same thing. It's like, okay, the students, it's understandable, the students, but why are the adults doing this? What's going on with this? And with regards to Portland, I mean, Evergreen's much more crunchier than Portland, and it's got some problems. Portland's pretty rich, you know. But Portland, I lived there from 2000 to 2010 or so.
Oh.
It was just like a perfect place. It was like almost like on the verge of being perfect because it was food and it was nice.
2015 was pretty good in Portland, I got to say.
Yeah. Every time I started going back to Portland and visiting from Olympia, I'm like, it's getting more and more Portland. It started becoming Portland. I think it was Portlandia that did it to Portland and stuff. But it's odd that this utopia, and I felt that during the Barack Obama era. I'm like, we're disconnected from the world. Everything's so good here. I think that we're kind of losing connection with hardship. And, you know, I just had this sense like it's almost too good to be true.
Oh, it's interesting.
It's just interesting. Just to wrap up, they got in a bubble progressively that everything was working, and then they completely denied why progressivism works or something. They lost connection, at least the adults did, to a backbone, to no, to the word no or something.
Yeah. You know, there's I can't remember the quote, but in one of the pieces that I wrote for a reason, I followed around a trans activist who embedded with Black Bloc.
Oh, Erin, yeah.
Erin Smith, who's great. Yeah. Oh, I love her. And she gave me a great quote from, I can't remember where it's from, but it's in the piece, talking about how people actually want to fight. They want something to fight against, which I think is true, right? Or to fight for. And if they don't have enough problems, they'll create problems, right? So Portland was just so great. Right? It was so great. Well, we got to have something to fight against. But I think there's a little more to it in Portland. I think people, and I've written about this, I had a piece in the May issue of Reason, a feature called The Dream of the 90s Died in Portland. Mm-hmm. People came, they came to achieve their achievable dreams, right? I'm going to build this thing and it's going to be perfect, and the weather and bicycle lanes and the chicken
beards
in the yard and,
yeah,
and free weed or whatever. And then they got there and it was like, Portland didn't just like bring their dreams on a platter. And I was like, hey, whose fault is this? This is messed up. And so it had to be someone's fault, right? It couldn't just be your fault, or it couldn't be that you need to kind of be an adult about things and like, and cater, you know, and change your dreams or work harder for it or whatever it was. Yeah. And so people started lashing out at whatever, you know, they saw as the authority, you know, the main ones that you can always lash out at because they wear a uniform, which are like the police or people in city government or your landlords, you know. These were the people that were keeping you and keeping the world from being more fair. Mm-hmm. But you started out asking something else, and I've taken us on a tangent.
Well, I was going to bounce back to storytelling / or comma or semicolon journalism, whatever the relationship between those two things are.
M dash.
With regards to fiction, one basic low-level piece of advice is keep the conflict high, or conflict is what you need conflict. With regards to nonfiction journalism, I was just thinking about you seeing people saying that people are creating conflict because they need conflict. And doesn't a story need conflict? And I'm just associating with what you're saying, where you can always find gold. It doesn't necessarily have to be conflict.
There has to be that sort of like spark in rotation, right? That brings you to the story. What is it? It's a glint you see in someone's eye. It's the way a kid breaks his ankle. It's a, you know, an old guy with gin blossoms on his nose. What's his story? Like, something will capture you. And then, like, I wrote a little novel a bunch of years ago, and I knew the name of the book. I knew the opening scene, and I knew the very last sentence. So all I needed to do is figure out how to get from there to there, right? Something, and you know, it's there. I gotta say, there's any art, any good work that you're going to do has a little bit of like little breath of mystery in it, right? Like, because like, why am I compelled to write this thing, and you're compelled to write this other thing, or it's the exact same thing? Nancy, Benjamin, go in the kitchen and look at that piece of orange cake, write about it. We're not going to write the same thing, which is great, right? Is it conflict? I guess I think it's what fascinates the writer, and then that leads to something else, and then it fascinates the reader. I think that if you're fascinated by something, no matter what it is, I've said before, Joan Didion or William Langsfisha could write a 200-page book about tying their shoes, and I will read the book, okay? So it's the writer is bringing something to this work. Conflict, yes, but also, you know, conflict for the sake of conflict is cheap, right? It's become sentimental. It becomes a device. So, yeah. Careful, mm-hmm. kids.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. So to reflect back on storytelling / journalism and what I've been saying for a while, and it's odd because I've been interviewed myself like 3 times and we keep on talking about what I'm trying to do with being like this content creator. I'm not a journalist. Okay. I just create content. So just with the attention marketplace, your job, you have 3 main parts of what you're trying to do. Is one is to capture attention, maintain attention is the second thing, and then change attention or modulate attention. And that's a sticky point, but I'll go back to what you were saying about the book about the bridge. Mm-hmm. Is that everybody's changed their ideas, or they are the story changes. Like you are kind of prestidigitating, or you're working a magic to unveil something, and everybody comes out knowing something different or feeling something different, or even just thinking about the world differently. And that's the real gold with the content. It's not necessarily the content, it's the content's effect on attention, I would argue, but you still have to go through and find all that gold yourself, because that's what's creating that change or creating that value in the content. So with regards to the way that journalism, broadly speaking, is going, it seems like there's 3 different things that they're trying to do. And one is capture attention. We can criticize how they're capturing attention and not really following through on the story, not really maintaining attention, and not really doing anything that's valuable at the end other than some sort of political point, it seems like. It seems like maybe one of the faults of journalism is that it is motivated by justice or by something else. Trying to get to a question, but
well, you know, if I've been here because I actually have a very, very strong opinion about this. I absolutely and 100% think, as my job as a journalist is not to tell the reader how to feel ever. I have no objective for you. I don't. I am going to tell the story, mm-hmm. and I'm going to leave enough air between the lines, or whatever you want to call it. You get to decide. Now, if you read my book, you have a reading group and you're going to read To the Bridge. All of you are not going to feel the same way at the end. And that's great, because I am not leading you to a conclusion. Who the hell am I to tell you how you're supposed to think about something? It's like me cooking a dish of beef stroganoff and everybody better love it and love it in exactly the same way. It's like, no, some dude's going to like the mushrooms and some the gravy, and other people going to be like, I don't like this at all. It's not my job to tell you what to feel. And I absolutely 100% agree with you. Journalists now, many of them have an objective, and their objective is A, help Trump, B, help Biden, C, make sure that you feel like super good about this particular issue, make sure you feel super bad about this issue, make sure that you hate the people we hate right now, and I'm going to give you just enough information that I've cherry-picked and maybe had given to me that shouldn't have been given to me, so that you start hating the right people so that this person is destroyed in public. This is what some journalists do now, and they call it journalism. I find it reprehensible. I would never do that kind of journalism. I don't think it is the job of the journalist to have an objective. That said, people, and I've been complimented on this from people saying, I like the way you write because you don't tell me what to think. You let me think myself. Yes, because I want to assume that everyone who reads me is smarter than me, right? They're all smarter than me. So what the hell am I going to tell them what to think, right? Cool, I'll give you the stuff. However, I will say, you have to remember who put the story together for you. I put the story together for you. It doesn't mean I would never, oh my God, leave out salient pieces so that you would think a certain way. That's completely unethical. If I'm writing a story about you and your 5 friends and you held up a store and crashed a car and then kissed your mother, like, would I leave out the kissing your mother so they think you're worse? Would I leave out the car crashing and the stealing so that you think you're better? Like, no, you can't do that. I have to give you the story as I found it. But that is not what's happening now in journalism. And it's being, and worse than that, publications are like, yeah, that's our job now, man. It's our job. It's our job to like, and come on, let's be frank. This has probably happened since the beginning of time. You know, you're going to have one conservative publication, one liberal publication, or one this or one that. I do. And I could be wrong. I've only lived in this time, so I don't know. And even if you read about historical accounts, can you trust what they're saying? I don't know. Yeah. I just think that it seems very, very fraught right now with people wanting to make sure their team wins. I find I'm not on anybody's team. I literally am on no one's team.
It seems like, there's a number of different ways to analyze that. And one person that I've had on, BJ Campbell, talks about the monetary way that it happens, that Fox News is going to sell Carhartts, the overalls and trucks, and then CNN's going to sell Bentleys and, I don't know, some sort of foie or whatever. I don't know what they do. Sorry, Priuses.
Right? Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. There we go. Right. So there's market forces that are dictating that things are going to sell to these people, and those ideas sell to those people too. So we're going to tailor our things. And also it's the public's responsibility for running towards media that reflects or reifies their priors, right? So a lot of people consume the content that resonates with their opinion already. So it seems to be the case that when you turn up the heat, that becomes stronger and stronger and stronger. And maybe the dream of the 90s did allow, maybe there was enough wiggle room for people to do that kind of work. Or maybe there are conditions where people can create content that's not ideologically based or pointed. But in certain fraught times, the ideology, because the stakes are so high, the ideology has to be us versus them, or our team has to get this stuff done. So we need to, you know, rally the troops, and the journalist becomes the piper that's marching the band, perhaps.
You know, you're right. So I lived in L.A. until 2004. And when I left, there were, you know, there were three or four alt weeklies. You had the Time. You had a lot of different things that you could read. I got to Portland. There was the same. Well, as we know, because of the way media goes, it was based on advertising and everybody fled and they went online. You have fewer and fewer publications. I mean, you open up your alt weekly online and the first thing they're doing is asking you for money because they have no money. Then you have fewer voices, and then you've got, you know, concentrated in these areas like, well, you know, the New York Times is going to report this way. And now we don't have, you know, 17 other papers in New York. However, the eternal optimist here, we got the internet.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. We have more voices than ever.
We are. Now, does that mean that it's a cacophony? Well, sometimes. But, you know, we find kind of what we like. And I think that people, I mean, look at my beloved Barry Weiss. You know, she has gone off and she is creating, you know, what she wants to create. And she has done that, you know, on her own. And she has people, voices there that she feels are important to the conversation. Great. I'm building Paloma Media. We have people here in the studio and we're going to have stuff online. People that I think what they're saying, it's definitely going to be kind of from across the spectrum, or is interesting, but they share a sensibility in that they don't feel like going for your jugular, which is, you know, kind of a good thing. We like to be chill over here. Okay. I am optimistic because I think that humans can't help but create. And I think that we will hopefully create great stuff. And there's more and more opportunities to create great stuff. Does that mean that the Fox News and the CNN, are they going to behave? Well, no, but you know, go.
Are you going to behave?
I'm such a good girl. No, I'm not. I'm actually not very well behaved. And in that people think I'm not well behaved because I don't, you know, whatever, reify their priors.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I'm going to tell you what I saw. You know, I'm sorry if you don't like that. I mean, the one, I've said this a million times before, the funniest one was I was in Portland in front of the federal building. You know, the federal troops were inside and it was just mayhem outside and people were burning things. And there was this guy and he had a fire extinguisher and he was smashing through the plywood, particle board plywood that they had put over the windows of the federal building. And I'm filming it. And you've got like, you know, the black block kids and everything in their black helmets, screaming. I'm filming them. I put it online later because I was reporting for a reason. And this guy comes on and goes, you know, I can see that Nancy Rommelman staged this in a studio. And you know how I can tell? You can tell from the shine on this guy's helmet. I'm like, how much do you think Reason pays me? Like, I mean, what? This was just like...
You deep faked the Portland riots.
Fake, that's me. It's just like people see what they want to see, right? Yeah. So, but then I become the bad guy. It's just hilarious, you know? But you just keep doing your work. I just keep doing the work.
So in the emergent field of the democratization of story journalism, storytelling, and even information, and even interpretation of facts, and all that gets in the way of facts, which is a whole other thing, especially when the facts get really scientific, you know, with regards to things that are happening currently and how do we interpret that data and all this stuff. And then it gets politicized and so on and so forth. One of my friends at Rebel Wisdom, David Fuller, was he was wrestling with Brett and Heather about the how to respond. Yeah. With ivermectin and how to respond to that. And they were kind of going at it. And at some point, kind of towards the end of that heated debate or whatever it was, and there were so many different voices and everybody had 20 papers. It was just such a mess. I couldn't understand what was going on. But David advanced the idea, and this is not censorship. I want to reframe it. It seems like it could be censorship, but I don't think it needs to be censorship, but some sort of code of ethics for podcasting. Like, what are the code of ethics? And one thing that you're talking about is truth and not lying and dedication to, you know, just telling the story at all. But it seems like if we can come up with some sort of like chivalrous code for podcasters that is totally elective, we could steer ourselves towards quality. Perhaps. What do you think about that?
Well, it's an interesting idea, but then it comes down like, well, who decides, you know?
Well, yeah.
And also,
what would they be? And so you have to do it with your own Paloma Media. You guys do, whether explicitly or implicitly, have some sort of code.
I think we just, I mean, the people that we have in the room, like physically, and then we'll have online, the thing that they share, because people are like, is it left? Is it right? Is it libertarian? It's like, they share a sensibility. And the sensibility is they're interested in, you know, good writing, fact-based, a little jackassing, some fun, some delight, not here to destroy people. And that's just,
sounds like the culmination of the Gen X mission.
Let's see. You can find out in about a week and a half. But, you know, I think that, I mean, I tend to not be a joiner. So if like someone said, like, will you sign this code of ethics? I'd probably be like, eh, nah. But I think it's easy. God, it's so, is it, okay, here's a question for you. Is it, do you think people really do want to, whether it's online or whether it's on Evergreen or whatever, that they do kind of want to behave with kindness and ethically, but they just are afraid to do that because then they're going to be seen as not a team player? Like, look at those kids at Evergreen, or look at, like, okay. I think
are you
sometimes
talk about the
people,
Republicans
people
in the
are
Senate?
I think people are afraid to be kind because, you know, let's say someone's being destroyed online and they want to say something nice and they want to make this person feel better or they want to protect this person, but then they get destroyed too. I mean, we've seen this 1,000 times. So they just don't say anything at all. And so I wonder if, like, people just went their own way. Most people would just be sort of kind and ethical, but it's the loud people that are screaming this and that. Those are the ones that get like weird sunshine and people think you have to obey them, but you just don't. You don't.
You can go your own way.
Should we sing it?
That's, it was in my head. Are you, can you do Stevie?
No, but I can do a pretty good Linda Ronstadt. But, you know, this is, we were talking about Fleetwood Mac the other day. Fleetwood Mac is the only band that I know of that, like, each generation from, like, the boomers to Gen X to millennials to Gen Z, everybody likes them. Like, they just keep going. I know. Seems to me, at least.
Maybe it was all those rituals they did at this studio that they worked at. I don't know.
There we go.
Well, that's a good question, and it might be kind of egotistical or even boring to ask, but what about having an ambition to create something that does stand the test of time? Or you ever have that, like, I need to do Didion, but Didion plus? Or did you ever have that motivation? And insofar as you did have that motivation, have you gotten any clue on how to do that?
Do you mean, like, how do I immortalize myself as a writer?
Well, no, not you yourself. I mean, that's one way to fake it, but just like a work of art, like Rumors, you know, like can I create a Rumors out of nonfiction kind of thing?
I will say that there are certain stories that I've done that I've referred to as they'll come in the coffin with me, ones that I absolutely stand by, like 100%. And I also say it's, I don't know, it sounds egotistical or not. I guess I don't mean it that way. To the Bridge is the book I think I always was meant to write and was writing even when I didn't, the story hadn't even happened yet. Like that book is, I mean, maybe at some point I'll read it and say, I think I've read it twice. Besides the billion times you have to read it when you're writing a book and editing it, I think I've reread it only once. You know, you wrote the book you wanted to read and that you wanted to write, and you got that down like forever. Yeah, that actually, when you write that work, that does feel pretty good. It feels pretty good. But, you know, it doesn't last. You got to do the next one.
You got to keep on. The content must flow.
That's right. You got to do it. You can only dine out on it for so long. I have a good story about that, actually. I'm going to give some props to someone here. The writer, Catherine Boo, who wrote Behind the Beautiful Forevers, which I was assigned to review and then interview her. We met up in Portland. She already knew my work. We became friendly. I wrote to her something about To the Bridge while I was writing it. I was kind of frustrated or something, and she wrote me back just something super sweet. I get up the next morning and I read that she had won the National Book Award the night before. Okay. And I wrote to her, I emailed her, I was like, Kate, oh my God, what the hell were you doing writing back to me when you had just won the National Book Award? You must feel amazing. And she said, Nancy, I would rather, not that she wasn't happy to win it, I'm sure, I would rather be where you are right now when you're still walking into the story and trying to figure out what's going on. That's where the satisfaction is. The satisfaction is like finding the story, finding the surprising stuff, the crazy frustrations that you will face. Then you get to it, you realize you've gotten it, then you can like add the beauty bits, which is like the most incredible thing. Like when you've worked, it's like you've run 25.9% of the marathon, and then you get that, it's like you get to make it, it's almost holy, like this shit starts sifting down, words, ideas, connections, it's like putting stars on it, right? And then it lives,
bejeweling your
it's an incredible feeling. And then of course publication day is fun, of course that's fun, and you do some stuff, but you know what, that satisfaction, you can't, it doesn't last. It doesn't last. It's advancing. So you got to go do the next thing.
It's like a shark, all cartilage, and you got to move to breathe.
Yeah, we're all sharks.
With regards to those handful of articles, or however many there are, maybe there are two handfuls of articles that you'll take with your grade. What are some of the qualities to that you think make them, if you could just like kind of fish and...
Well, none of them, I never walked into any of them. You know, you go into stories a lot of the time. You're like, I think this is what this story is about. I think that's what it is. And then you get there and it turns out to be completely, like, if not completely different, extremely different than you thought it was going to be. And then you let the story tell itself to you. Oh, my God, this is like, it's incredible, right? It's so cool. And then you stay with it. And that, you know, because you haven't pre-decided anything. You can't pre-decide the story, like, ever. Like, that's completely illegitimate, right?
You can hear the last line sometimes before you begin.
You can, and actually that did wind up being my last line. But, you know, there were 8,422 lines in between that I had to figure out. That's all. I think the stories that you know, one thing you were talking about, the reader staying with you. One thing about To the Bridge is I was discovering the story, and I am discovering the story along with the reader. Like, you are coming with me as my mind is also being changed. For some readers, this was a little confusing because the timeline kind of goes back and forth. There's a dateline on the stories. Okay, you know, whatever. I can't please everybody. But you are, if you're discovering the story – as you go, that's pretty thrilling. And I think a lot of the stories that meant a lot to me, that was the case.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How did the Bridge book change you then? Like at the end of it?
Oh. I don't know, except I guess to be a better writer, because it takes a lot of work, you know? I did want to just say one thing mentioned here, because you asked about those stories, and many of them came because I wrote for the LA Weekly for 15 years. And I just want to give props to the LA Weekly that was. It was a place where you could write 8,000-word cover stories, and I would do a couple of those every year. Or I would say to my editor, Janet Duckworth, who then went to the LA Times, I'd say, oh, man, I was hanging out at this, like, old man bar down, like, this old single-room occupancy hotel down in you know, downtown L.A. Man, it's a wreck, and the guy, and this and that. She's like, I want 6,000 words on it. Just, like, boom. Like, okay. And you would, and they'd pay you. Like, you know, you get a dollar a word. Like, you could make a living writing stories about stuff that or isn't really, in quotes, a story, but it is, because you're talking about human beings. Okay, that was just, sorry, there was a little digression there. But what did To the Bridge teach me? Well, that there are no shortcuts if you're writing this stuff. There just aren't. If you're gonna tell a hard story, you're gonna have to last. You're gonna have to take a long time. You're gonna have to make a ton of mistakes. You're gonna give up. Oh man, I gave up on that book twice. But
it didn't give up on you.
Well, no, that's true. I'll tell you another tiny little story, which is kind of, it's kind of got so corny. Your viewer is going to be like, this woman, shut up. That little novel that I wrote, The Bad Mother, is about these street kids in Hollywood. It was all fiction. It was not off of my journalism. I'd never interviewed a street kid, but I couldn't do it. I didn't know how to do it. Didn't know how to write a novel. I put the pages, like actual physical pages, in a shoebox. And I had it in my office in LA when I lived in LA. And I was typing on an article. And all of a sudden, I felt this, like, almost like a chill down my neck or something. And I didn't turn around. But if I had, I would have seen the characters in that book climb out of the shoebox and stand there. They were little. They were like 6 inches tall. And look at me and say, are you going to forget about us too? And so I went back and I finished the novel. Yeah. Anyway.
Paloma Media.
Yeah.
What's the, I guess we don't have elevator pitches anymore. What's the tweet?
The tweet is, it's, first of all, it's named after the cocktail, the tequila cocktail. Not people are like, oh, is it named after the dove for peace? I'm like, yeah, no, it's named after the tequila cocktail. We trash it up. We just do it with like tequila and Fresca. Basically, we built out the studio, just kind of, this is literally attached to my apartment. It was this little like pony apartment. We just built the studio, threw some stuff in here. It's totally punk rock. There's no investors or anything. We just started podcasting. Fifth Column started podcasting from here. Started doing YouTubing from here too. Got a YouTube channel. And then really we wanted to build out a website where there's going to be original journalism and aggregated stuff. Video, podcasting that will run other people's stuff, we'll run our own, and just make it hopefully interesting and somewhat delightful. It's a little jackassy. I hope it's beautiful and sexy, and people can come and, you know, enjoy it for a little part of the day. That's really those are my ambitions. Yeah. There's no investors. There's no, like, I've got a 5-year plan. It's like I'm stumbling my way toward it, but I gotta say, it looks pretty cute. And I hope it's going to be launching in about a week and a half. We got a lot of getting little bugs out right now.
So, okay.
Yeah.
And with regards to story, you do have a Substack, which
do.
I'll link. But is there a big story, or is there another one saying "Don't forget me"? Or I have you cornered.
What do you mean another?
On the future, on the horizon. No, like a story, story.
Well, that's interesting. So, the Substack's called Make More Pie, which is also kind of the motto for Paloma Media, right? I think it's a little better than Democracy Dies in Darkness, right? So, I don't know. It's depending on
depends on what's in the pie. Is it blackbirds?
I have noodled on two different books since To the Bridge came out, and then I wound up doing neither. One reason is I went off and I moved to New York and have been doing that from Portland. Number two, I went in and started reporting about Portland, which has taken up like about a year, year and a half. And then I had like a little bit of a cancel culture thing that I was going to write. I just got bored. Like, I just didn't about that. I just
cancel
didn't.
Culture.
So
cancel,
now we're
cancel
doing,
culture. Girl.
Cancel. I canceled that. And then I'm doing Paloma now. And and then let's see. You know, that's got a that's a bit of work. And but I'm sure there's another book or so in me. Yeah.
And with regards to going from the page to the podcast, and I'll let you go because I know New York Minute, I've taken like many of them. With regards to going from, you know, writer to speaker and AV thing, going from the written to the oral tradition, how has that translation been for you?
I love it. I'm a hand. It's like back to the movie star, man. Like, right?
Oh,
it's my henchman. It's my chance. No, I love
it.
yay. I love being on camera. I love talking to people. I plan to do some stuff with Paloma, like come on Friday mornings and talk to people about like what we had all week. We've got the YouTube and now we got, I love when people like talk to us, even though I'm nearsighted as a bat and I have to squint at the screen to see what it is. I like communicating with people, and for me it's fun. I love doing the YouTube, and I like the podcasting, and I like it.
Does it? It suits you.
Yeah,
it's kind of a different thing than maybe not. Maybe you always hear your words when you're writing them, and it's like you're just talking to a page.
First of all, writing is very different than just talking, but I do have to, I think a lot of writers are like this. It's a sonic experience for me. I got to hear the sentences. And I've had editors sometimes start tearing up the sentences. I'm like, listen, I am super easy to work with. I get my work in on time. I'm happy to edit, but do not start tearing up my sentences because I'm going to lose it because I can't hear it anymore. The story doesn't, it becomes all discordant. I will say we've got, you can go over to the, Paloma Media Podcast, that's, you know, wherever you get your podcast or catchers, Apple, Spotify. But I am going to be launching a new podcast called Lunch on Dime Square, where I'm going to be interviewing people. Did my first one. I interviewed the author Nick Flynn. That'll be coming up. We'll be launching that when we launch the site. But
Lunch on Times Square?
No, this is going to be, it's going to confuse everyone, and I don't care. Maybe I'll change the name of it. Lunch on Dime Square. So Dime Square is right here in Chinatown. It's a really, really, really interesting little place right here in Chinatown. I live on it, and that's what I'm called. For now, till enough people go, Nancy, that's a shitty name. But for now, that's what it's called. So
I'm having some naming problems with my own brand right now, so I have to figure that out, too.
Okay. Right.
Nancy Rollman, thank you so much for your time and for sharing your stories about stories. I felt like I learned a lot talking to you.
I thank you for – it was really fun. I like talking about this stuff, so thank you so much.